Beast speaking, far seeking, future telling. Those terms ring a bell for you? I know it will for a lot of you out there listening, because at some stage in your life, many of you will have picked up a book by Isabel Carmody. Her Ober Newton books are some of the most popular fantasy novels written, especially amongst young adults. She started writing her first book when she was just 14 years old. Now, over four decades later, Isabel is about to release the seventh and final instalment in this series, and she joins me in the Breakfast Studio. Isabel Carmody, welcome to RN Breakfast.
Thanks, Fran.
It's a pleasure to have you with us. This has been an enormous project for you over a very long time. You wrote the first of the Chronicles when you were just 14 years old. When you began, did you have any sense of what lay ahead of you?
No, not a chance. I mean, in those days, we didn't meet authors. You didn't see authors doing the rounds. So the idea of being an author was even more remote than being an astronaut. So it wasn't even that it was a dream I couldn't possibly have. It was just simply not on my radar to
become an
author.
So what was on your radar when you sat in your room? You lived in country Australia, regional Australia. You wrote this book in a very crowded household, as I've read about your life. What was it? What was propelling you?
I think I wrote for most the same reason most people read, which was for solace, to try and figure things out for myself, because I was lonely, because I was looking for something and answers, mostly trying to figure things out, I suppose, more than anything else.
And those feelings that you talked about there, that solace, trying to figure things out, has that remained a tool of the a raison d'être for the books that have come since then, or was that really the 14-year-old in you that started it off? What's propelled you to keep going with the Chronicles?
Well, I think that I'm still that 14-year-old. I mean, all the ages that we were don't die. We're like one age inside the other, like Matryoshka dolls. So I think I'm still propelled to some extent by the things that my characters formed around those questions. And yeah, I still write for the same reasons, to figure things out.
So you wrote this at age 14. It didn't get published till some years later. I think you're in your 20s, and then it got published. But it has found an audience, particularly, it's found an audience amongst people of all ages, I think. The numbers, the figures tell us that, but mainly young adults. You're much older than 14 now, dare
yes.
I say. You've been writing for some decades, these books. How have you maintained the voice that resonates with young adults? Have you consciously done that?
No, I didn't write for young adults. I was a young adult when I started to write. And I think I just was writing very strongly out of those feelings that I had when I was young. And like I said, they still exist inside of you. If I write a 14-year-old well enough, no matter what age you are, you can understand that character and you can recognise that character. So I think I'm still, those concerns that I had at 14, I still have now at 57. And, you know, concerns about the world, concerns about power and oppression and tyranny of all kinds of things. I mean, those are great philosophical questions. And they're not questions that adults ask. They're questions that teenagers ask because they're the only ones with the time, although we are taking that away from them bit by bit with exams and homework and all the rest of it. But for me, that was a time that was very philosophical. And what surprises me year after year is how philosophical adolescents are, because they write letters of 80-page letters to me.
80 pages to you?
Yeah.
And what's the themes of their letters?
Exactly this. Concerns about the world, what's going to happen, what they're frightened. A lot of the time kids are frightened and they're concerned. But on this tour, what I'm noticing people are telling me most, and I'm always touched and maybe a little bit amused by this too, that they feel they survived childhood because of those books. I mean, they were my way of surviving childhood. And it's a little bit daunting to discover that other people can feel that way too, because I feel it's an undeserved reward they're offering me when they praise me for it, because they're saying thank you for something that I did for perfectly selfish reasons to survive myself.
It's quite a load to have on your shoulders too, the thought that your books are helping people survive childhood.
I think you can't think of that when you write. You don't think about other people. You can't think about other people when you write, or at least I can't.
You have said before, I know, that one of your goals in writing the series was to find out for yourself if humans can be better, kinder, more empathetic. So that kind of philosophical question we're discussing there. And you had the group The Misfits, which is a funny name for the group who's trying to find a better, kinder world. But what did you conclude At the end of these chronicles?
The end of that we have to evolve. We have to evolve ethically and morally. We have to be ready to change. We can't see humanity as being the pinnacle of existence, because a pinnacle is a point that you come to and then stop. There needs to be a more open and emergent sense of things constantly changing. We don't fight a battle against oppression once and win it. We fight it forever, like we fight our worst instincts forever. And so it's a constant striving. And that sense of being a misfit is a sense of being in a world that you don't really understand, that you want to be better. And kids feel that, and I feel it too, that yearning for the world to get better, for us to get better, that longing. And every sign you see of change in the world, like I saw on the internet the other day that Hamburg's hoping to be a car-free city at some point, which I think sounds absolutely fantastic, and I wish that would exist. And I love stories like that because they give me hope that the world is capable of changing. Humans are capable of changing.
It's inevitable, the comparison between the Obi Newton Chronicles and the Hunger Games, I think. And the Hunger Games, of course, you know, took over the world. And your book's in a way a precursor to those themes and style and fantasy. Do you see that? Do you see yourselves in the same box? And is that explained by that philosophical search that you were talking about before?
I'm not sure. I mean, for me, I really enjoyed Suzanne Collins' Hunger Games. It was very racy and really exciting read. And my daughter, I read it to my daughter, and it was really thrilling to read, and I enjoyed it. I would say that there are less levels, and I don't mean that really as a any kind of disregard of Suzanne herself, but it's just that the pressure to publish is very strong once you produce something that's good. And I've been really privileged in having a long period over which to write the books, because it enabled me to put in a lot of layers that books often can't achieve. They could achieve it. Of course they could, if writers were given time to develop. And I think there's just so much pressure now to produce and put out and gratify instantly any desire. Where's that beautiful thing called yearning that can only come if a desire is not instantly gratified? And I think that for me, I've been able to, I guess, produce some yearning over the years accidentally by taking as long as I have.
You didn't feel that pressure to churn the books out more quickly?
Oh, yeah, there was certainly, people would tell you in the early days of my career, Isabel, you have to finish this series or people will stop reading you. And I can say today that I'm material proof that they don't stop reading you, that you can keep writing and keep being read, and you can, there's a longevity that you can achieve as a writer. And I think it's a fight for, it's always going to be a fight to produce the best that you can produce, fight for yourself within your own life, fight for time in which to write and to create, but also a fight against people who would turn writing into an industry. You do have to fight against that too. You have to maintain your own idea of what's good and what's finished.
It's 22 past eight. Isabel Carmody is our guest. She's the author of the Obi Newton Chronicles. I know a lot of you won't need me to tell you that. Her latest, the final in the series, I'm sad to say, is The Red Queen, which is out now. That fight for time you talk about there, the flip side of that is so many people love these books, adore these books, yearn for these books, that yearning you talked about there. There is one person in particular who I think it's worth mentioning today, because she contacted you and her letter made a real impact on you. You've dedicated this final book to her. Her name is Tash. Tell us about Tash.
Oh, well, this is a hard thing to talk about. Her mum wrote to me, Angela Arizu wrote to me, and said that her daughter was dying of a rare form of cancer, and she went into her daughter and found her crying, and the daughter said that she was crying for all the things she was going to miss out in life. She was only 16 at the time. I had a 16-year-old daughter too. And one of the things that she was crying about was that she would miss out on was the end of the Obi Newton Chronicles. And you can imagine what it felt like to read that. And it's not the only letter like that I've had, but that one was a direct request for some kind of help. And she said, I don't know if you've got a manuscript or not, but if you've got any kind of closure you can give my daughter, I would really value it. And I ended up, just to cut a long story short, I ended up reading the manuscript that I had, 700 pages of it then, to her over Skype over months on end. And of course, she didn't reach the end of it. so. And I was talking to the publishers on the last day about how I passed the last time her name was in the manuscript, because the way that I would find her each day in the manuscript when we read was that I would look for her name by finding Tash. And of course, towards the end of writing, I came to her name for the last time. So, and it just seemed very appropriate for me to dedicate the book to her, because in a way I couldn't take her to the end, and I can't be everything to everybody. And it's that daunting thing where you suddenly realise that as much as this means to you, it actually means something to other people too, and it's bigger than you. It's an alchemy between book and reader. And it isn't me who's doing it. It's something to do with their imagination and what they bring to the book. And the book allows itself to be, you know, used in some way by those people and helping them. And that's actually amazing.
What an incredible process that must have been. And was it a two-way process as you read to Tash? Did she ask questions that...
Yeah, she did. And she was very much, that's never happened to me before with a book. And normally I would just not allow it. I don't read it. I don't show it to anybody. But we would, because I was in the middle of the night, the time difference, and Tash was often unable to sleep, and I'm an insomniac anyway, so we would often meet in the middle of the night. She was one of the night people that I came to know over my life, maybe the most important night person. And she would sometimes say, I'd say, oh, no, that's horrible, because it was a rough thing I was reading. I'd say, oh, no, I won't read that, that's horrible. And she'd say, I love that bit. Or she would say, yeah, I like the other bit better. So it was really amazing to have that conversation with her.
What a trusting thing and a generous thing on your part, but what a great thing for her too, to be able to sort of directly feed back to this thing that was so important to her. It's a beautiful story. Isabel, this is the last one, number 7. You've declared it's the last. How does it feel to let it go?
Bittersweet. I mean, the funny thing is, after all the pressure and some of it quite acrimonious over the years to finish, there's a lot of people out there now not wanting to have bought the book and who are not reading it, wanting to make it last for a bit longer. And I get that, you know, because I'm also a reader, and I also am impatiently waiting for the ends of books that I love or another book from someone I love. And there's this thing that where you get a book that you love and you read it so fast and you go back and you read it again. And that's one of the things that's also been lovely over the years. I was that kid who reread books I loved over and over again. And suddenly to find that my books are that book for other people. It's just amazing. I mean, it's not expected.
On behalf of all those people, thank you for the Chronicles, the Over Newton Chronicles, and good luck with Life Without Them. Isabel Carmody, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Fran.
Isabel Carmody, and the final installment in her Over Newton Chronicles is called The Red Queen, and rush to the bookshop now because it's there right now.